Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
MovementForModernLife.com, revolutionising online yoga and well-being, is proud to be sponsor of RadioGorgeous.com.
My name is Andrea Gillies, and I'm a writer of fiction and non-fiction, and my novel, The Enlightenment of Nina Findlay, has just come out, and I live in Edinburgh, in Scotland.
And if I understand correctly, you just had your launch party in Edinburgh.
Yes, we had a traditional Scottish birthing party for the book, which included quite a lot of alcohol, and a reading and a question and answer session at a bookshop in Edinburgh, which was very nice. It's good to have an occasion around the birth of a book.
Especially since you spend so much time writing it. I was looking at your tips on your website as a writer, and it seems to me that it is a very solitary experience for you, and it's a really long one, involving lots and lots of paper and tea.
A lot of paper, a lot of tea. Yes, someone who's an aspiring novelist said to me the other day, they were looking forward to the creative fulfilment of being a writer, and I was in rather a brutal mood, I admit. I did say to them, it's a very solitary life, and it requires enormous stamina to get from an idea to a finished draft. I mean, I must have done 20 drafts of this book, and you just need to keep doggedly going on and refining and refining and checking stuff out and putting new stuff in until it feels just right. It must be like painting an oil painting, I think, you know. You get to the point where you add the little bits of black and the little bits of white, the shadows and the light, and then you just have to leave it alone. And it's quite difficult to do that. I'm writing another book now, and Nina and her love triangle are still with me and trying to intrude.
Is her story not finished in your mind somehow?
Her story is finished, but I'm not sure she knows that.
You tell her to shush. Shush! I'm working on something else now. Go away.
Yes, it can slightly be creepy when the voice in your head becomes almost, you know, self-determining and starts chatting to you in your sleep, which does happen.
Wow.
It's almost a very odd life of being a novelist, which is that you live with imaginary people. I'm on my own most of the time, and the imaginary people are people I talk to all day.
That strikes me. If we can go to a little bit about your journey as a writer, because your first book, Keeper, was nonfiction.
Yes.
And if you could tell us the story about that.
Well, it was actually 10 years ago now that my mother-in-law developed Alzheimer's disease, and she very rapidly got to the middle stage in which she was just too ill to live with her husband in their own house. And so we moved them up. We all took this enormously risky and, in retrospect, wacky, whimsical leap and moved into this enormous house, in fact, on a small island in Orkney in the north of Scotland. And they moved in with us. We did bed and breakfast as well, which it was a crazy idea. And I wrote a diary of the 2 years that I spent more or less full-time. Well, I suppose it was part-time because we had helpers, but looking after her was my main focus. And it was a diary that became a manuscript. I wrote a piece for The Guardian about the experience, and it got picked up and became a book. And then, to my enormous surprise, won the Wellcome Prize for science writing and then the Orwell Prize for political writing, because it does have a political aspect, which is that we don't take dementia seriously enough and we don't take the happiness of the elderly seriously enough in general.
Yeah. Yes, we've decided your contribution is done.
Yes, I've done my thing. Mm-hmm. Everyone else has to take a turn now.
Yeah.
It was a very dark period of my life in some ways.
I can't...
Always until that point, I've not realised until that point how biologically determined a self is. But living with somebody who was losing their self, literally, physically, disintegrating in front of my eyes, with no idea who she was, who we were, where she was, or even at the end what objects were, what a pint of milk looked like.
Yeah, and
it was an extraordinary experience to go through, and in very many ways I'm still writing about it, because both of the novels I've written, both Nina Findlay and my previous one, The White Lie, are about memory in a way. They loop back into the past all the time and see things as they really were. And that's a key part of the way I write.
And that's, to me, memory and identity are so mixed. And I had a similar experience, not in any way. I did not move to a remote island with my family, my in-laws, try and keep horses, chickens, and invite other people into the madness. And then, you know, and everything else that you were doing.
I think the idea was really that to make it as mad as possible.
I think you succeeded.
There wasn't any point doing it in a half-hearted way. It had to be full-on craziness. And that's what made it actually survivable, because it was so eccentric.
And so I imagine, you know, so 100% engrossing, because the other thing, without memory, you are very, very unpredictable.
Yes.
And one of the ways we live in a family and get along is habits, you know, and she didn't have any, I would imagine.
No, I mean, very, very quickly, after a glorious first summer, in which everybody was very happy and everything was very beautiful because the island had not yet, you know, revealed itself to us, which is basically that it's 9 months of winter. After that, there was a rapid deterioration, because the last thing we should have done is to move her out of her known environment.
Yeah.
She couldn't learn. It's not only about losing the memory, it's about losing the power to make memory.
Yes.
People don't realise that. So she couldn't learn her new environment. And so that confusion led very quickly to fear and then to hostility.
Yes.
And she became hostile with the grandchildren, which is a point at which, after 2 years, we had to press the red button. Because people were being hit and things were being said that shouldn't be said, and the whole thing was descending into chaos.
Which
is a real learning curve.
And
I had tried to write novels before that point. I mean, I had written a version of The White Lie before we moved to the island. Very interestingly, it didn't really work until I'd had the experience of dementia. I rewrote the book from the point of view of the dead 19-year-old boy, Michael, who was drowned in the loch under perhaps mysterious circumstances, perhaps murdered. And it's all about this narrative looping, this unlinear narrative looping backwards and forwards. And that was very much the way that my mother-in-law's mind seemed to work. She was in the present in a fractured, fragmented way, and then was in the past, and could actually, in the course of one day, have been her 5-year-old self, her 25-year-old self, newly married, desperate to get to work, looking for her office clothes, and then looking in the mirror and seeing an 80-year-old woman there and terrified by it. So, in a way, you know, her life had become a novel.
I'm really pleased to hear you speak about it in that way, and in such a loving way, which must have been so difficult to maintain at times.
Certainly under the glare of the hostility with the children and with me, because I very quickly became that woman. Mm-hmm. She talked about in very disparaging terms, the woman who tried to make her do things.
Yep. Yeah.
But see, you carry forward, those of us who have memory carry forward with us an idea of someone that's out of date, which is what you cling on to when somebody has become someone else.
Mm-hmm.
She had a very loving grandmother, and so we carried that forward with us.
I suspect your children have a much richer, it born out of pain and confusion, but a much richer idea of what it is to grow old.
We know how it's that thing where some people have a look in their eyes, a soulfulness that comes from living in difficult circumstances or having come close to aggression, death, disease. It's a terrible thing when it happens to very young people in a way, but in another way, when they graduated out of that lifestyle, they left it as more rounded people who, for children, had a much richer appreciation of life and its travails and the terrible things that it can bring.
Yeah.
Which I think, in a way, has stood them in good stead. They're much more mature and they're much more aware of the elderly's issues, you know, even literally. So, I think it's been excellent for them.
Yes, out of adversity.
We're compartmented now as a society, aren't we? We don't live, well, most of us don't live in 3 or 4 generation households, as used to be quite commonplace, and is still commonplace in parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think, you Many children don't really have much contact with their grandparents under very controlled circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
To live with people is a very different experience.
Yeah, to see the warts and all.
Yes, and if someone has a fatal brain disease, then you know there are even more aspects to that.
It strikes me. Okay, so it seems like, as you say, a sort of romantic, mad notion. Move to an island, you know, family, horses, chickens, in-laws, etc.
When you put it like that, it sounds like an exercise in self-deception.
Well, as it turns out, perhaps it was.
About.
Well, that's the thing I was thinking that also is possibly a theme in your writing, is romance as not romantic. You know, this romantic notions as completely not romantic. Which brings me to Nina.
What really goes on in people's heads?
Yeah.
There are sort of three forms of consciousness in our novel. You describe what people do, you describe what people say, but you also have a chance to talk about what they think and to see inside their heads. And it's that third aspect in relation to what they do and what they say that fascinates me, where mm-hmm. people can think one thing and do another. And mm-hmm. that's going on all the time in Nina Findlay. You see what people are thinking. And then what they do is at odds with that, and what
yes.
they say.
Yeah, yes.
Nina herself embodies the idea of self-deception because she spent her whole adult life under the impression that the love triangle she's involved in with her husband and his brother enriches her life, when in fact it's threatening to destroy it and is undermining it every day.
Yeah, and is wildly stifling.
And the fact that you can't really know people is another... That's something that comes out of the dementia experience as well, I think.
Mm.
The fact that people... You can be utterly confident that you know someone, but one day they may act completely out of character and may be revealed to you in a completely different light, which is what happens to her. Someone she considers to be her best friend suddenly looks as if they might be her enemy.
Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous. Health, Beauty and Wellbeing on Radio Gorgeous is brought to you by movementformodernlife.com.
Could you give, we've been talking sort of about what Nina, the enlightenment of Nina Findlay is about, but if you could just put it in more introductory terms for our listeners, that would be great.
Trying to avoid spoilers.
Yes.
Because
absolutely.
The enlightenment of Nina Findlay is in fact a series of enlightenments, which is a bit like a Chinese box.
Mm-hmm.
You keep thinking you've got to the bottom of the origins of her catastrophe. She's had a catastrophe. What's happened to her is that she lives inside a love triangle, her husband and his brother, although it's an unusual one. And there's a very delicate balance in that, which begins to unravel once her sister-in-law becomes ill. The whole delicate balance is thrown off. There's a series of very surprising events, culminating in something very shocking, which causes her marriage to disintegrate. She runs away to a Greek island, having had a sort of breakdown in a cottage that she moves into, which she becomes convinced is haunted by her own mistake. And in Greece, is involved in a dramatic road accident, ends up in a hospital by the shore, and becomes very quickly intimate with an over-attentive doctor, who's a rather handsome man, and begins to talk herself into being romantically involved with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the situation that takes up most of the book.
Yes. Like I said...
Is she now in a love quadrangle? and what is she going to do now?
Yes. What's wonderful as a reader is that you sort of go along with her. You're not quite sure.
She's an unreliable narrator.
Yes, exactly. So you're not quite sure whether to believe her or yourself. It's sort of like Groucho in, I forget which Marx Brothers movies. Who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes?
That's a good quote. I like that. Yes. Well, because I love to work in this way of the narrative looping, so that it's not a linear story. You're with Nina in the Greek hospital throughout the book, but you're also being taken back to key events that may illustrate or they may contradict the point that she's making. So as a reader, you have to find your own way through. I'm interested in puzzles. I like puzzles. The White Lie is written as a puzzle. And you finally arrive at the solution, which makes the first chapter make sense to you. And that's very much the way with Nina as well.
I really like those the nice circularity that brings. You know, that's it's very satisfying.
And writing it almost as a detective novel, because I like red herrings and wrong turnings, and to you know, the misfootings that lead you down one path and then make you realise that you've been actually led astray by your narrator.
Tricksy. Yes, and Nina is a very tricksy, very compelling, but very tricksy narrator and lead character, in the fact that her own sort of self-aggrandizing, you know, is initially off-putting, but then very familiar.
She has self-esteem issues, which are then illustrated to come out of her childhood and her parents' very odd relationship, which in a way has been a catalyst for the whole catastrophe, because of advice from her mother and what her father tells her about the marriage and other things that come to light. So self-esteem issues are at the root of many of her issues, because she has bolstered herself with the love of two men in an effort not ever to be hurt, which is obviously going to backfire horribly, and does.
Yes.
But, you know, the thing with her is she's, to put it in slightly Jane Austen terms, she is alluring, accomplished, deluded, always the heroine of her own life.
Yes. Yes. It's a wonderful read. Tell us, because I haven't read The White Lie, could you tell us a bit about that book?
Well, that was the book that I found I could only write really after I'd been a carer of someone with dementia. It's set in a stately home type manor house in the north of Scotland in isolation. An aristocratic family of four generations live there. They're very much down on their luck. The money is very short. The grandeur is belied by the way they live. They live inside a secret, which proves to be two secrets, because there's another death a long time ago, which was the cause of the recent problem. I say recent, it was actually 14 years before the novel opens. Their 19-year-old grandson of Edith and Henry, who are the residents of Petey House, this estate, has disappeared, having said he was going to run away because he was very miserable about his childhood, has disappeared into the loch on the estate, and his aunt, 42-year-old Ursula, who is an unusual person who was very much damaged by the loss of her 4-year-old brother when she was 5, who also drowned in the loch. She comes running into the house one day saying that she's killed Michael, that she hit him across the head with an oar in the rowing boat on the loch, and that he's drowned. And the whole novel revisits that scenario from the point of view of different narrators until we arrive at the truth. And there are lots of red herrings. There are very many unreliable narrators. The key thing that interested me about the situation was that they live inside a secret that they're determined not to tell, and how that threatens to unravel the whole family. Technically, it was a very difficult book for a first novel. I made it as difficult for myself as possible, which isn't unusual.
That does sound like your MO.
It is. The book I'm writing now, actually, I'm trying to do differently. I'm writing in a linear way. It's about a lay nun who comes to a village and causes chaos with her advice. It starts on day one and it ends on day 14, and it turns out that she's not the person that we think she is.
Red herrings.
There are red herrings, but there is no narrative looping. There's none of this very tricksy going backwards and forwards, which makes it technically difficult.
You said it when we first started talking that now, you know, you're not surrounded by people, that, you know, that you're more or less living with your characters. Was it, and you didn't start writing novels until you were 51. Is that because finally it's quiet enough for, you know, your characters to come in?
Yes, there's room now for them to come sit on the sofa next to me. I do enjoy the solitary life of the writer. I'm peopling it with my own people. They don't argue with me, which is good. It is important, though, to get out of the house sometimes. I have a dog. The reason I have a dog is so that I'm not in my pyjamas all day. Because we spend a little part of each day writing in a coffee shop with lots of people around me.
Yes.
And I see my children often. Meanwhile, I have two of them still living at home, so they're in and out. So it's not a completely solitary life, but it needs to be solitary enough in order for your imaginary world to seem real to you.
Mm-hmm. To give it real architecture.
Yes, writing a novel, a lot of people who haven't done it don't appreciate, is a feat of concentration. The scenario you're writing about needs to be absolutely real to you. You need to let it inhabit your mind in a way that is actually quite meditative and takes you out of the present. There have been occasions when I've been writing when one of my children has been standing in front of the laptop for 10 minutes saying, "Mom, Mom, Mom, hello," and I haven't been aware of them.
Well, that is a turnaround from the teenage thing. You know, you're saying, dinner's off the table.
It's like I have my own Xbox, only it's a novel.
Exactly. So there you go. You're the Xbox in your head. Wonderful. And so you said you're the novel you're working on now. Where are you, if I can use your own words, on draft one and getting to draft two as soon as possible? Are you in the throes of 1A through Z, or have you gotten on to draft number two?
I'm still on the first stage, which is what I call the blurt, which is a crazy ride through the book and letting it talk to me and going off in all sorts of tangents and ending up with a big baggy manuscript, which I'm about to print out. When I've stopped talking to you this morning, I'm going to write the final chapter. I'm ready. I've written 140,000 words since January the 2nd.
Wow!
Yes. I go for it. I absolutely do. I never read back. I just go forwards and I keep writing, and I'm sometimes aware that I'm going down the wrong road, but I keep going. I get to the end of that road, then I'll find a new road, and I just let all possibilities be expressed. And then I do a big printout, and that's the point I'm at. So there'll probably be another two drafts before it goes off to be read by other people, which is the very nerve-wracking part.
Wow, I'm impressed that you could actually sustain a conversation while you're still living in that, you know, just before that moment.
Yes, interestingly, it was quite difficult for me to think about Nina Findlay this morning before you called. I had to look at the book again and read a little bit of it and think about it, because I've already parked Nina Findlay. I'm already on into my next alternative reality. And the people who are real to me at the moment are not the people in the Nina book. They're the people in the book I'm writing, which is the villagers and the visitor. It is a bit like, you know, recording everything on a cassette tape. That's a very, oh gosh, I've showed my age. Recording everything onto an internet peg thing. Oh, it's the cloud. That's it. It's not the cloud. She's still there, but she's not, you know, in my laptop. She's gone off.
Yeah.
Yes, it is quite difficult when you're between books, which you are when one book is published and you're writing another one.
Yeah, you're sort of promoting one, but it must seem like, you know, you're reporting on a trip you took 10 years ago or something.
Yes, yeah, so talking about Keeper, that feels like really ancient history to me now. I only have a very vague idea of what I wrote in Keeper. The White Lie seems quite sketchy as well. Nina is reasonably filled out, but the book I'm living in is the one I'm writing. They're the people who seem real to me.
Excellent. I can't wait to hear it.
As someone said once, every novel is the ruination of a great idea.
Well, you seem to not have... you're saying ruination is the only time I've heard you say, in our short acquaintance, anything remotely about judgment. Because you seem to... It's this... When you're writing and you're... reading your writing finally, it's without judgment. It's just what works for the story.
Yes. I steer clear of the whole idea of judgment. I have an idea and I want to express it in the best way that I can. It's a storytelling process. I had a story to tell about Nina Findlay and her series of enlightenments that brought her finally to a sort of adult version of herself. that interested me, especially someone who's just gone through a divorce. And I'm doing something similar now with a different set of people who have a different problem, problems and solutions. And so judgment doesn't really come into that. It's what works, as you say. And I steer clear of judgment to the point at which I don't look at my reviews. There are certain websites I steer clear of because I know that people like to give people a good mashing there and dent them. And that's not good for morale.
No.
I live in the world I live in. For me, the transaction is between my thoughts and the person who reads them. And as long as people keep buying the books and reading them, that's enough for me.
I think that's part of what you said about the marathon of writing. Because I think so often what happens to people is that they get lost in, is this good, or is this, you know, and what does this writing say about me? And you have to muscle past all that and keep going.
As a writer, especially a new writer, to steer clear of introspection and of being hasty about judgment. First drafts are always terrible. Even J.K. Rowling and Ian McEwan and all the greats, they find the same thing. A first draft is always a terrible thing. It looks awful. It doesn't tell the story you want it to. Of course it's not going to. It's your first encounter with your story. You're just getting the story down. That's the important thing. I don't even begin to think about the quality of what I'm doing until it's about to go to my agent, which will be the third. We call it the first draft. It's a sort of joke we have between ourselves, but, you know, it could be the third, it could be the 19th. We call it the first draft. At that point, I'm happy for another person's judgment. But until then, I don't judge myself. What I think about is this good at what it tried to be?
And the judgment
gets... the story I want to tell, and I'm happy with it, then that's fine. You know, not all people are going to like what you do. I've already had one stinker of review for Nina, which seemed completely to miss the point of the book. But that's life.
Yeah.
Everyone's a critic now.
Yes. Back when we did just have tape recorders.
Yes.
But now that everyone has the vehicle, yes, everyone's a critic.
Well, because of the internet, well, everybody is a writer and everybody is a critic.
And a filmmaker and a... Yes.
Yeah, we're all creators now. We're all critics of creators.
Yeah, yeah.
Even on YouTube.
Yep.
That's the world we live in. You do have to toughen up. I mean, I do say to people, you know, not only is it quite a lonely existence, not only is it a huge feat of stamina and concentration to produce this end product which is saleable, but the experience after it comes out can be absolutely brutal.
Yeah.
And you have to have a thick skin.
Yeah, it's a bit the big postpartum.
It is.
Oh, Andrea, it's been so lovely to chat with you this morning.
Oh, thank you, Donna. It's been lovely to talk to you too.
Exactly. I've had my second cup of coffee with you. It's fantastic.
I've been drinking tea.
And now you're going back to the final chapter.
I am. I'm not absolutely sure how it's going to end.
How exciting.
The character is so real to me now that she is going to lead the way to the end of the book.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, so...
She's whispering to me while I'm talking to you.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so I'm considering this part one. Because when that comes out, I want to know part two. What happened in between this second right here and when that comes out?
You have a deal. I'll write a little blog piece later, which I won't publish, about what today was like and how the last chapter was written.
Oh, fantastic. I can't wait. Thank you so much, Andrea.
Thank you, Donna. Lovely to talk to you.
And you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous. Today's show is brought to you by movementformodernlife.com.